Well, David has given up all hope of reconciling now with this unstable and thoroughly fallen King Saul. And as a result, he took the drastic and morally questionable step of moving his large and growing army of disaffected Israelites, and no doubt their families, out of Israel after he made a deal with the Philistine king of Gath. Now, some years later, David had fled to Moab and had intentions of allying with the king of Moab and residing there. But a prophet named Gad told David he wasn't to leave Judah and to live outside of Israel to escape Saul. But here, he was doing just that. Now, Achish welcomed David and his 600 men as defectors, whereas only a couple of years earlier, he had seized David as he fled alone from Saul's wrath. David had to pretend that he was insane in order to escape Judah and Moab, but now he's voluntarily returned to Philistia with a bargaining chip, an army, to help the king of Gath achieve his ambitions. And at first, David and his men stayed in the royal city of Gath as guests of the king, but that wore thin on both sides. So David asked if he could be granted a place out in the countryside to move his army. And now Achish was only too glad to comply, because no doubt there was friction between David's people and his from both a political and a social perspective. After all, we do have a large contingent of Hebrews suddenly moving in with what had been, up to now, a long-time sworn enemy. An enemy with a substantially different culture, a pagan Philistine culture, which was quite different than that of the Israelites. Now, it's important to understand that just as Israel had been a confederation of 12 tribes. Oops. Got it, guys? Okay. That Israel had been a confederation of 12 independent tribes ever since they entered the promised land under Joshua, and that Saul was the first to have some limited access in uniting these tribes towards nationhood, so it was for the Philistines. Philistia was not a sovereign nation under a single government leader. At this time, it consisted of 5 independent kings over 5 cities and their outlying territories. They were a confederation of 5 small kingdoms consisting of the same ethnic people, and they were close allies, but that's about as far as it went. So the king of Gath made this decision on his own to allow David and his army to settle in his territory. Now, the other 4 Philistine kings probably didn't benefit from this arrangement and probably even thought it was dangerous, knowing David. In fact, we're going to see in the next chapter, they were pretty suspicious of David. Well, Achish assigned David the village in the area of Ziklag for his own. Now, for David, this was ideal. This would have been a racially mixed village, comprised of some Hebrews and some Philistines. Ziklag was at one time an Israelite town that belonged to Judah, that the Philistines captured it and now controlled it by no means meant that the Hebrews were all kicked out. Rather, those Hebrews remained who were willing to accept kind of a vassal status or even subjugation to Achish, or those who really had no means to leave and go anywhere else. So they were joined by some Philistines who moved in. Now, this would have been a much more comfortable and familiar accommodation for David and all of his men and their families than that thoroughly Philistine capital city of Gath. Further, David was now deep enough into Philistine territory to discourage Saul from pursuing him, but far enough into the Philistine countryside that Achish wouldn't be entirely aware of David's daily activities. But there was a disadvantage as well. Ziklag was sufficiently isolated to be vulnerable to attack from these various tribes of desert marauders, including the Amalekites. So let's reread part of 1 Samuel chapter 27 to get us started this evening. 1 Samuel chapter 27, we're going to start at verse 7. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 329. Chapter 27, verse 7. After David had been living in the country of the Philistines for a year and 4 months, he and his men began going up and raiding the Geshuri, the Gesuri, and the Amaleki. From ancient times, these people had lived in the land in the direction of Shur all the way to Egypt. Now David would attack the land, leaving alive neither men nor women, but taking the sheep, cattle, donkeys, camels, and clothing. Then he would return and go to Achish. And Achish would ask, "Who were you raiding today?" And David would answer, "Against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of the Yerachmeli, or against the Negev of the Kenai." And the reason David spared neither men nor women to be brought to Gath is that he thought, "We don't want them telling on us, saying David did so-and-so." That's how he conducted his raids for as long as he lived in the country of the Philistines. And Achish believed him. And he said, "David has caused his own people Israel to despise him utterly. He'll be my servant forever." Once David and his men had gained a measure of trust from Achish and established themselves into the territory of Ziklag, a time that's listed, by the way, as a year and 4 months, there began a substantial change in their behavior. They attacked and they plundered nearby tribes as a means of making a living. No doubt they learned much about Philistine military tactics and methods, and this served them well, both now in their raiding, and then later on when David was king, and he had to take on the Philistines in battle. Our complete Jewish Bible and other Bibles say that David's army especially picked on the Geshurites, the Gerizzites, and the Amalekites. Actually, it was probably just the Geshurites and the Amalekites. The Hebrew word typically translated as Gerizzites is Gesuri, and it literally means separated or cut off ones. The Geshurite people were known to have lived primarily in the Transjordan region, but there's a record of a group of them that migrated to the Gaza area, the area of the Philistines. So very probably the intervention of this, or rather the intention of this biblical wording was originally meant to explain that those who David attacked were some Geshurites who had migrated to the Upper Sinai toward Shur, originally from the other side of the Jordan River. They were a band of Geshurites who had Gesuri separated themselves from the main tribal stomping grounds on the east side of the river, and they moved to Philistine lands. In any case, David's methods were utterly ruthless. His army killed everyone they encountered, men and women. He took all of their belongings, their domesticated animals, everything as loot. Very probably the Geshurites were allies of the Amalekites, or at least they were on friendly terms. And so from one perspective, David may have felt quite justified in annihilating the Geshurites along with the mortal enemies of God, Amalek. But on the other hand, there's no mention that David felt he was fighting a holy war, or that he was under God's direction to slaughter these folks. And I seriously doubt that David was actually so delusional as to think that it was a pious act to regularly plunder and kill them all. Now, both Christian and Jewish Bible commentators have strained to find proper justification for David to engage in these activities. Some have gone so far as to make the killing and the looting a divinely directed purpose, even if it was kind of mysterious. Now, I can't go that route. There's just no attempt by the writer of these passages to characterize David's attacks as good or evil, but merely to report them honestly as historical fact. Now, the purpose is to specifically raid and plunder, and then David would report the results to Achish. Without doubt, the devious and cunning David is working both sides of the highway. He's attacking enemies of Israel, which is going to endear him in time to the many clans that form Israelite Judah, and those who he is attacking are also apparently not friends of the Philistines. So the Philistines are okay with it. By bringing a report of his activities to Achish, and certainly a portion of the booty as a gift, David's gaining Achish's trust, his admiration, as well as increasing Achish's treasury. So he's okay with it. But then verse 10 paints a picture of David's nearly complete autonomy as he operates his army out of Ziklag. And the king of Gath doesn't tell David who to raid. Rather, he asks David who David has decided to raid. "Who are you raiding today?" says Achish. And David would tell him, "Oh, the Negev of Judah, the Negev of the Jeremelites, the Negev of the Kenites, or something like that." Now, what's instructive is that it was always the Negev of somebody. The Negev has become a formal place name now. But in David's day, it just more meant the southern territory or just the south. Today, we would identify these areas as those that center around Beersheba and then further south to areas approaching even the Arabian Peninsula. Now notice that these areas are far away from Saul's area of influence, the north of Canaan, thus giving Israel's king no cause to oppose David in his forays. Now verse 11 says that the reason that David killed all the Amalekites and the Geshurites, was so they didn't report the details of his activities to Achish. Thus, we're left with no doubt that David's purpose for slaughtering these people had little, if anything, to do with God's command to Israel to destroy Amalek. Killing those people allowed David to operate in secret. King Achish knew only of the amount of plunder that David decided to tell him about. David could have amassed much more in the way of weapons and wealth than Achish had any idea about. And further, the Philistines, well, they weren't barbarians, and they may not have approved of David's ruthless tactics. But verse 12 reveals something that we shouldn't take lightly. That because David operated in the Negev, the south of Judah, meaning territory that belonged to the tribe of Judah, which was his own tribe, Achish figured that David must now be seen as a pariah to his own people. And thus David had burned all bridges to his past. Now he's nothing less than a naturalized Philistine. Now, are we to assume that David has completely fooled Achish? He has no intent of actually being loyal to Philistia. Could it be that this whole thing was an elaborate ruse? And David is actually doing things that are distasteful to him. But it's all for a higher, although very secret purpose. Or is David so far off the reservation that he truly has let his circumstances dictate that the dark side of his character, his evil inclination, has now taken firm hold? It's almost as though he's got at least one foot onto the same road that eventually Saul chose, and it led to his failed kingship and total abandonment by Jehovah. Now, as I said earlier, This is a topic that's carefully avoided by commentators because of the can of worms that it opens. But I think that it is one that demonstrates a very great lesson to us. Heroes, including Bible heroes, are by nature flawed. And yet, those major flaws are often what facilitates their heroic actions and enables them to be able to do them. You know, I can recall my father, who served in World War II, telling me about General Patton and that that man was loathed by his men and terribly feared by his enemies. This was because General Patton was as arrogant as a Roman emperor, as attention-seeking as a diva, as ruthless as Genghis Khan, and as stone-cold as a mortician. But he was also a brilliant tactician. The man simply loved war. He had no use in this world if he wasn't a warrior at war. Patton was a typically flawed hero who achieved great victories, largely because he had no problem doing things other men would never think to do or allow themselves to do. David can be legitimately called a type, a shadow of Messiah. The true Messiah would even come from David's hereditary lineage. But that in no way means that David was an early version of Messiah. Nor does it mean that David's character was to be compared with Yeshua's. If we can learn anything from this, it is that David was a mere man, even though he was hand-picked by God to be the first king over a united and sovereign Israel. He could be tempted, and he could fail. He could be moral and idealistic, and yet he could commit terrible injustices out of pragmatism and self-centeredness. When faced with personal peril, he could be unbelievably courageous, like in the Goliath incident. And he could become fearful, take any path to survival, no matter who else was harmed in the process, as in the Priests of Nob massacre. And here we find David unapologetically throwing in with Israel's arch enemy, the Philistines, for protection, for friendship. In fact, there's every indication that unless God intervened yet again, David could have remained in the service of Achish as a Philistine all of his days. There's no hint of a plan by David to eventually return to his own people in Judah. David had a heart for God. That's not even open for debate. But he also had a desire for life. He wanted to live as a leader of men. And we're going to find out later that he also had a desire for beautiful women, no matter what their legal marital status might have been. He had a bit of a crusader mentality. So he would put his own life on the line to right what he saw as moral wrongs. He valued life on the one hand, but on the other hand, he could take life without remorse if he felt it was justifiable in his own eyes. He was amazingly deep and introspective, as demonstrated by his many psalms. He was also impulsive and rash, as demonstrated by his determination to kill Nabal for merely being insulted. To keep his own activities private by killing countless men and women just so Achish couldn't question them. And yet God loved him, and he used him mightily. And outside of God's own son, Yeshua, he may be the most revered Bible hero by Christian and Jew alike, and the most beloved of the Divine Father. See, this ought to give every one of us who loves the Lord the greatest hope. Even when we fail miserably, provided we maintain unwavering loyalty to God, He'll continue to claim us. Even through those stages of our lives that we're too embarrassed to reveal to even those closest to us, after some of our darkest moments, God can still use us for His kingdom if we'll stick to Him. And if we won't close off that possibility on our own accord, due to our shame and our guilt and belief that there can't be any possible way, that we are anything now but shattered and useless vessels. Folks, for unfathomable reasons, God decided to love mankind, to use imperfect beings to achieve His perfect and holy purposes. And despite this rocky road and doubling back and false starts and all kinds of failed attempts that are inherent to all endeavors of humankind, the Creator made a choice. It is common among Christians to say, well, God uses men because that's all He's got to use. That's not true. Jehovah has legions of angels to do His bidding. They're far more obedient, more powerful than we are. They're created more holy than we are. They're even allowed into God's very presence. God didn't choose David because David was more perfect or more able than other men. He chose David because He foreknew that despite his failures and all of his stumbling, David would always choose loyalty to Jehovah. We all have a little bit of David in us. We also have a little bit of Saul in us. So who among us will become David? Who among us will become Saul? Which we become is going to be the result of our free wills. It's not going to be because of some unchangeable cosmic destiny that we were born under. Saul was not brought into this world condemned to become the anti-king. David was not born with the assurance of becoming the anointed king, no matter his behavior. Saul and David each knew the God of Israel. Each also put their foot onto the wrong path more than once. One corrected his way. He sincerely sought forgiveness, and he went on to become God's friend. The other one embraced the wrong path. He shook his fist at God. He became God's enemy. Let's move on to chapter 28. Chapter 28. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, page 330. In due time, the Philistines assembled their armies for war against Israel. And Achish told David, "You know, of course, that your men and you will join me and the army in battle." And David answered Achish, "Well, I see that you already know what your servant will do." And Achish said to David, "For that answer, I'm making you my personal bodyguard for life." Now, Shmuel, Samuel, was dead. All Israel had mourned him, buried him in his city of Ramah. Also, Shaul had expelled from the land those who tell the fortune by communicating with the dead or with a demonic spirit. The Philistines assembled. Then they went and pitched camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all Israel together and pitched camp at Gilboa. And when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he became afraid. It struck terror in his heart. But when he consulted Adonai, Adonai didn't answer him. Not by dreams, not by Urim, not by the prophets. And then Saul said to his servants, try to find a woman who tells the fortune by communicating with the dead. I want to go and consult with her. And his servants answered him, yes, there is a woman in Ein Dor who tells the future by communicating with the dead. So Saul disguised himself by wearing different clothing, went with two men, came to the woman by night and said, tell me the future, please. Bring up the dead from the dead, the person I named to you. And the woman answered, here, you know what Saul did and how he expelled from the land those who tell the future by communicating with the dead or the demonic spirit. Why are you trying to entrap me into causing my own death? But Saul swore to her by Adonai, as Adonai lives, you will not be punished for doing this. Then the woman asked, whom should I bring up for you? He said, bring up for me Shmuel. And when the woman saw Samuel, she let out a shriek. And then the woman said to Saul, why have you deceived me, you yourself or Saul? And the king replied, don't be afraid. Just tell me what you see. And the woman said to Saul, I see a godlike being coming up out of the earth. And he asked her, what does he look like? And she said, an old man's coming up. He's wearing a cloak. Saul realized it was Samuel. So he bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. And Samuel asked Saul, why have you disturbed me, brought me up? Saul answered, well, I'm very upset because the Philistines are making war against me and God has left me and he doesn't answer me anymore and neither by my prophets or not by dreams. This is why I've called you, so that you can let me know what to do. And Samuel said, why ask me? If God has left you and become your enemy, Adonai has done for himself what he foretold through me. Adonai has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to your fellow countryman, David, because you didn't obey what Adonai said and execute his furious anger towards Amalek. That's why Adonai is doing this to you today. And Adonai is giving Israel as well as yourself over into the power of the Philistines. And tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. Adonai will hand over Israel's army to the power of the Philistines. Saul immediately fell full length on the ground. He became terribly frightened because of what Samuel had said. He had no strength left in him, for he'd eaten nothing all that day and night. And the woman approached Saul, saw that he was panic-stricken, and said to him, here, your servant listened to what you said. I put my life in my hands and did what you requested me to do. Now, therefore, please, listen to what your servant says. Let me put a little food in front of you and then eat so you'll have some strength when you go on your way. But he refused. He said, I won't eat. Then his servants together with the woman urged him and he heeded what they said. He got up off the ground and sat on the bed. And the woman had a fattened calf in the house and she hurried to slaughter it. And then she took flour and kneaded it and baked matzah with it. She served it to Saul, to his servants. They ate and afterwards they got up and they went away that night. The political situation is that a major confrontation is brewing between Israel and the Philistines. And verse 1 begins, in those days. See, this is just a standard Hebrew phrase that's meant to give us a time reference and to initiate a new subject. Therefore, what this chapter describes sequentially happens after the events of chapter 27, yet not so long after that there's a definite connection between the two stories. The reason for this coming war, well, they're not given, because they're not relative to the purpose of the story. Achish says to David, it's a foregone conclusion that David's going to fight on the Philistines against his fellow Hebrews, right? David was caught up in a vice. Up to now, his removal from his own people, Israel, and his binding himself to Israel's enemy, Philistia, had proved advantageous. It was highly profitable for him. But he had chosen to participate in a dangerous game, and it was only a matter of time, or he was going to have to take a public stance. Would he fight for his own people, or would he fight against them? Even more, who are his people now? With whom is he identified? David responds to Achish such that Achish takes it to mean that David has given unquestioned loyalty over to him. He's so taken by David's response that in verse 2, Achish makes David his Somer Lo Rosh, the keeper of my head. That is his personal bodyguard. But if one looks closely at what David said to Achish, the words were kind of ambiguous. There wasn't any promise of loyalty. There was really no commitment to fight alongside Achish. Rather, all David said was that the king was well aware of what David's fighting capabilities were. And if we stopped right here, we'd think that David would do many things to enrich himself and aid the Philistines in the process, if it was all necessary. But there's little chance he'd actually fight against his own brethren on Achish's behalf. Thus, that's why he was being so clever, so vague in his response. But if we thought that, we'd be wrong. To set the stage for what happens next, the writer or the editor of this portion of 1 Samuel reminds us that the greatest prophet, Samuel, has died. In fact, he had died before David had defected to Philistia. Further, after his death, King Saul had, for some unspoken reason, expelled all the diviners and the necromancers from Israel. I mean, was this some kind of a temporary pang of religious fervor upon Samuel's death that had prompted this in Saul? Well, now, necromancers are those who conjure up the spirits of the dead and communicate with them. There were other diviners who openly made contact with demonic spirits, but no matter. The Torah law forbids such a thing on any level. Leviticus 19:31. Do not turn to spirit mediums or sorcerers. Don't seek them out to be defiled by them. I'm Adonai, your God. Leviticus 20, verse 6. The person who turns to spirit mediums and sorcerers to go fornicating after them, I will set myself against him and cut him off from his people. Verse 4 sets the scene. The Philistines have advanced for war, and they've set up a battle camp at Shunem, which is located on a mountainside opposite of Gilboa, where King Saul had set up his opposing battle camp. Now, Gilboa was located on the northeastern edge of the Jezreel Valley. No doubt the two sides could see one another. That was customary in those days. By foot, those two camps were probably no more than 2 hours apart. So we see that the coming battle would take place where countless battles had been fought for centuries and would be fought for millennia. The Valley of Jezreel, the same place where the Battle of Armageddon is going to be waged. This was well north of Judah and of the Negev where David operated. And this makes sense because Saul's tribal coalition consisted entirely now of the northern Israelite tribes. And this is where the Philistines would have desired to operate more freely since their ally David had Judah under control. Well, when Saul took a long look at this Philistine army arrayed out in front of him, he went into a panic. Already the utter darkness of despair had gathered around Saul. He was condemned. Oh, he knew it. He felt it. His tormented conscience convulsed in the knowledge of this. What was going to happen when the sun rose tomorrow morning and those armies raced at one another with deadly intentions? His overwhelming fear can only be understood, and it was finally sinking in. He was on his own. The Lord God of Israel had abandoned him completely, permanently. After all, if not for this reason, then what? He had fought the Philistines on a number of occasions, and he usually came out the victor. But this time, he was filled with foreboding and terrorized. It was understood in that era that the first thing that any army did before firing that first arrow in anger was to consult their gods for direction. No doubt the Philistines had consulted with Dagon, and they were confident of their victory. But what about Saul? Samuel made it clear that his God had withdrawn from Saul, and no amount of groveling or insistence was going to reverse that situation. Saul had no gods to consult. And knowing that he desperately needed some kind of direction, some kind of wisdom from the spiritual sphere in order to have any chance against these Philistines, he proceeded as though by using the standard Torah protocols in a mechanical fashion, that the Lord would have a little choice but to communicate with him and give him what he sought. And verse 6 explains that he used every means known to him to consult God, but he received no response. Thus, we get a brief list of the biblically approved ways that God communicated with men: by dreams, by Urim and Thummim, and by prophets. Dreams were a means that the Lord often used to talk to lay people, the common Israelites. The use of the Urim and Thummim stones was limited to the high priest, and the passage saying only Urim is just shorthand. Prophets spoke God's wisdom to the kings. So, not through his own dreams and not through the high priest did God speak to Saul. And of course, since Samuel was dead, Saul had no prophet to bring the Lord's oracle to him. To whom could he turn for answers? Shaul took his usual route. He tried to go around God's laws and commandments. He tried to obtain God's wisdom in some kind of an alternative way. And since you can't force a dream upon yourself or anybody else, as far as I know, and since the high priest apparently tried in vain in Saul's presence, but the Urim and Thummim would produce no answer for him, the only remaining choice was to get a prophet to give Saul God's wisdom. And since Samuel, his prophet, was dead, well, the only way to accomplish that was to have a necromancer call up Samuel from the grave. Now, I was kind of contemplating this, I thought to myself, isn't that the way of all humans in all ages and in all eras? Even Christians at times tend to think we can ignore God's laws and commandments and instead ask the Lord to bless our own ways, our own personal desires, our own methods. We get ourselves into a dire situation as a result, and then we hope, well, maybe we even expect, that the Lord will give us a different and better answer to our problem using unconventional or maybe even unbiblical means. Of course, because he's merciful and he loves us, we think he'll just kind of suspend his eternal laws and his commandments. Just this once, he'll give us a solution that we prefer better. And like Saul, we try to find that loophole to kind of go around the Lord's ways and his principles and his patterns, sincerely believing that perhaps we can find another way to get to him. Now, this sounds so irrational when I say it out loud, but boy, doesn't it sound logical when you try it? Saul decided to suspend the law he had as a king invoked. It was that all diviners and necromancers were to be expelled from Israel. And if any remained and practiced their black arts, they were to be executed. He invoked such a law rightly. Communicating with the spirits of the dead was one of the most heinous crimes against God. But the moment he felt threatened, His soul felt hollow from the absence of God. Yeah, the same king saw no conflict in trying to obtain the services of a spiritualist for himself. Now we can look at this, maybe chuckle a little bit at this ancient superstitious mind, but such belief lives on today in abundance. You can go to the local Yellow Pages and find fortune tellers by the dozens. Politicians, the famous and the wealthy, especially seek private spiritual advisors, they call them. I've seen TV pastors invoke Nostradamus. I've seen them invoke the Mayan calendar to back up their predictions, all the while calling on the name of Jesus. How about the use of tarot cards, seances, Ouija boards, little voodoo? You know, some may think they're as harmless as playing Monopoly. Others are dead serious in their attempt to contact spirits and ghosts for information. Every single one of these, no matter whether sought out by Jew, Christian, or agnostic, is nothing more than an attempt to get around God in order to acquire a higher wisdom in a very similar manner to King Saul was trying. King Saul tells his closest advisors to go and find him, a female necromancer. The Hebrew term is Baalat Ob, and it literally means ghost wife. A little more than 5 miles northeast from Shunem, the Philistine encampment, was a place called Ein Dor, where a well-known Baalat Ob lived. She had apparently agreed to quit her practice instead of leaving the area. Now, let's be clear. In general, the diviners and necromancers spoken of in the historical books of the Bible were Hebrews, unless an alternate nationality was given for them. So very hypocritically, Saul disguised himself, and he goes to this woman. He says he wants to know the future by means of her bringing up this dead person that he would name. The ancients believed that the dead had information on the future, and this was invariably the reason for attempting to consult the dead. Bringing up meant exactly that. The dead were thought to live underground in an underworld. Therefore, if you wanted to communicate with them, they had to come up to the world above them. Even more, the ghost had to be brought up, meaning against their will. Saul came at night to this woman because these rituals always occurred after dark. But the woman was leery. So she said, maybe this isn't something she ought to do, since the king had ordered it stopped. In fact, she thought it might have been a test. Maybe it was an attempt to entrap her that was going to lead to her death. But Saul swore to the woman in Jehovah's name this was not the case. No harm would come to her. I mean, isn't it bizarre that here we have King Saul consorting in the act of black magic to consult dead spirits, which, by the way, is a capital offense in the Torah, but then swearing in the name of the God of Israel is proof of his sincerity to this necromancer, this Baalat Ob. Saul wanted the divine to come to him by means of the anti-divine. Oh, how I wish that was a rare occurrence among God's people, but sadly, it's all too common. We're going to continue next week to examine the King of Israel's attempt to contact God by means of witchcraft.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.